This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chetris, London, UK. The Idle Thoughts of an Idle Fellow by Jerome K. Jerome. Section 2. On Being in Love. You've been in love, of course. If not, you've got it to come. Love is like the measles. We all have to go through it. Also, like the measles, we take it only once. One never need be afraid of catching it a second time. The man who has had it can go into the most dangerous places and play the most foolhardy tricks with perfect safety. He can picnic in shady woods, ramble through leafy aisles, and linger on mossy seats to watch the sunset. He fears a quiet country house no more than he would his own club. He can join a family party to go down the Rhine. He can, to see the last of a friend, venture into the very jaws of the marriage ceremony itself. He can keep his head through the whirl of a ravishing waltz and rest afterward in a dark conservatory, catching nothing more lasting than a cold. He can brave a moonlight walk adown sweet-scented lanes or a twilight pull among the sombre rushes. He can get over a stile without danger, scramble through a tangled hedge without being caught, come down a slippery path without falling. He can look into sunny eyes and not be dazzled. He listens to the siren voices, yet sails on with unveered helm. He clasps white hands in his, but no electric Lulu-like force holds him bound in their dainty pressure. No, we never sicken with love twice. Cupid spends no second arrow on the same heart. Love's handmaids are our lifelong friends. Respect and admiration and affection, our doors may always be left open for. But their great celestial master, in his royal progress, pays but one visit and departs. We like, we cherish, we are very, very fond of, but we never love again. A man's heart is a firework that once in its time flashes heavenward. Meteor-like, it blazes for a moment and lights with its glory the whole world beneath. Then the night of our sordid, commonplace life closes in around it, and the burned-out case, falling back to earth, lies useless and uncared for, slowly smouldering into ashes. Once, breaking loose from our prison bonds, we dare, as mighty old Prometheus dared, to scale the Olympian mount and snatch from Phoebus' chariot the fire of the gods. Happy those who, hastening down again ere it dies out, can kindle their earthly altars at its flame. Love is too pure a light to burn long among the noisome gases that we breathe. But before it is choked out, we may use it as a torch to ignite the cozy fire of affection. And, after all, that warming glow is more suited to our cold little back parlour of a world than is the burning spirit, love. Love should be the vestal fire of some mighty temple, some vast dim fane whose organ music is the rolling of the spheres. Affection will burn cheerily when the white flame of love is flickered out. Affection is a fire that can be fed from day to day and be piled up ever higher as the wintry years draw nigh. Old men and women can sit by it with their thin hands clasped. The little children can nestle down in front. The friend and neighbour has his welcome corner by its side. And even shaggy Fido and sleek Titty can toast their noses at the bars. Let us heap the coals of kindness upon that fire. Throw on your pleasant words, your gentle pressures of the hand, your thoughtful and unselfish deeds. Fan it with good humor, patience, and forbearance. You can let the wind blow and the rain fall unheeded then, for your hearth will be warm and bright, and the faces round it will make sunshine in spite of the clouds without. I am afraid, dear Edwin and Angelina, you expect too much from love. You think there is enough of your little hearts to feed this fierce, devouring passion for all your long lives. Ah, young folk, don't rely too much upon that unsteady flicker. It will dwindle and dwindle as the months roll on, and there is no replenishing the fuel. You will watch it die out in anger and disappointment. To each it will seem that it is the other who is growing colder. Edwin sees with bitterness that Angelina no longer runs to the gate to meet him, all smiles and blushes. And when he has a cough now, she doesn't begin to cry and, putting her arms around his neck, say that she cannot live without him. The most she will probably do is to suggest a lozenge, and even that in a tone implying that it is the noise more than anything else she is anxious to get rid of. Poor little Angelina, too, sheds silent tears, for Edwin has given up carrying her old handkerchief in the inside pocket of his waistcoat. Both are astonished at the falling off in the other one, but neither sees their own change. If they did, they would not suffer as they do. They would look for the cause in the right quarter, in the littleness of poor human nature, join hands over their common failing, and start building their house anew on a more earthly and enduring foundation. But we are so blind to our own shortcomings, so wide awake to those of others. Everything that happens to us is always the other person's fault. Angelina would have gone on loving Edwin for ever and ever and ever, if only Edwin had not grown so strange and different. Edwin would have adored Angelina through eternity, if Angelina had only remained the same as when he first adored her. It is a cheerless hour for you both when the lamp of love has gone out and the fire of affection is not yet lit, and you have to grope about in the cold, raw dawn of life to kindle it. God grant it catches light before the day is too far spent. Many sit shivering by the dead coals till night comes. But there, of what use is it to preach? Who that feels the rush of young love through his veins can think that it will ever flow feeble and slow? To the boy of 20, it seems impossible that he will not love as wildly at 60 as he does then. He cannot call to mind any middle-aged or elderly gentleman of his acquaintance who is known to exhibit symptoms of frantic attachment. But that does not interfere in his belief in himself. His love will never fall, whoever else's may. Nobody ever loved as he loves, and so, of course, the rest of the world's experience can be no guide in his case. Alas, alas, ere 30 he has joined the ranks of the sneerers. It is not his fault. Our passions, both the good and bad, cease with our blushes. We do not hate, nor grieve, nor joy, nor despair in our 30s like we did in our teens. Disappointment does not suggest suicide, and we quaff success without intoxication. We take all things in a minor key as we grow older. There are few majestic passages in the later acts of life's opera. Ambition takes a less ambitious aim. Honor becomes more reasonable and conveniently adapts itself to circumstances. And love dies. Irreverence for the dreams of youth soon creeps like a killing frost upon our hearts. the tender shoots and the expanding flowers are nipped and withered, and of a vine that yearned to stretch its tendrils round the world, there is left but a sapless stump. My fair friends will deem all this rank heresy, I know. So far from a man's not loving after he has passed boyhood, it is not till there is a good deal of grey in his hair that they think his protestations at all worthy of attention. Young ladies take their notions of our sex from the novels written by their own, and compared with the monstrosities that masquerade for men in the pages of that nightmare literature, Pythagoras's plucked bird and Frankenstein's demon were fair average specimens of humanity. In these so-called books, the chief lover, or Greek god, as he is admiringly referred to, by the way, they do not say which Greek god it is that the gentleman bears such a striking likeness to. It might be humpbacked Vulcan, or double-faced Janus, or even drivelling Silenus, the god of abstruse mysteries. He resembles the whole family of them, however, in being a blackguard, and perhaps this is what is meant. To even the little manliness his classical prototypes possessed, though, he can lay no claim whatever, being a listless, effeminate noodle on the shady side of 40. But, oh, the depth and strength of this elderly party's emotion for some bread-and-butter schoolgirl. Hide your heads, ye young Romeos and Leanders. This blasé old beau loves with an hysterical fervour that requires four adjectives to every noun to properly describe. It is well, dear ladies, for us old sinners that you study only books. Did you read Mankind, you would know that the lad's shy stammering tells a truer tale than our bold eloquence. A boy's love comes from a full heart. A man's is more often the result of a full stomach. Indeed, a man's sluggish current may not be called love compared with the rushing fountain that wells up when a boy's heart is struck with the heavenly rod. If you would taste love, drink of the pure stream that youth pours out at your feet. Do not wait till it has become a muddy river before you stoop to catch its waves. Or is it that you like its bitter flavour? That the clear, limpid water is insipid to your palate, and that the pollution of its aftercourse gives it a relish to your lips? Must we believe those who tell us that a hand foul with the filth of a shameful life is the only one a young girl cares to be caressed by? That is the teaching that is bawled out day by day from between those yellow covers. Do they ever pause to think, I wonder, those devil's lady helps, what mischief they are doing crawling about God's garden and telling childish Eves and silly Adams that sin is sweet and that decency is ridiculous and vulgar? How many an innocent girl do they not degrade into an evil-minded woman? To how many a weak lad do they not point out the dirty bypath as the shortest cut to a maiden's heart? It is not as if they wrote of life as it really is. Speak truth, and right will take care of itself. But their pictures are coarse daubs painted from the sickly fancies of their own diseased imagination. We want to think of women not as their own sex would show them, as Lorelei's luring us to destruction, but as good angels beckoning us upward. They have more power for good or evil than they dream of. It is just at the very age when a man's character is forming that he tumbles into love, and then the lass he loves has the making or marring of him. Unconsciously, he moulds himself to what she would have him, good or bad. I am sorry to have to be ungallant enough to say that I do not think they always use their influence for the best. Too often, the female world is bounded hard and fast within the limits of the commonplace. Their ideal hero is a prince of littleness, And to become that, many a powerful mind enchanted by love is lost to life and use and name and fame. And yet, women, you could make us so much better if you only would. It rests with you, more than with all the preachers, to roll this world a little nearer heaven. Chivalry is not dead. It only sleeps for want of work to do. It is you who must wake it to noble deeds. You must be worthy of knightly worship. You must be higher than ourselves. It was for Una that the Red Cross Knight did war. For no painted, mincing court dame could the dragon have been slain. Oh, ladies fair, be fair in mind and soul as well as face, so that brave knights may win glory in your service. Oh, woman, throw off your disguising cloaks of selfishness, effrontery, and affectation. Stand forth once more a queen in your royal robe of simple purity. A thousand swords, now rusting in ignoble sloth, shall leap from their scabbards to do battle for your honour against wrong. A thousand Sir Rowlands shall lay lance in rest, and fear, avarice, pleasure, and ambition shall go down in the dust before your colours. What noble deeds were we not ripe for in the days when we loved? What noble lives could we not have lived for her sake? Our love was a religion we could have died for. It was no mere human creature like ourselves that we adored. It was a queen that we paid homage to, a goddess that we worshipped. And how madly we did worship. How sweet it was to worship. Ah, lad, cherish love's young dream while it lasts. You will know too soon how truly little Tom Moore sang when he said that there was nothing half so sweet in life. Even when it brings misery, it is a wild, romantic misery, all unlike the dull, worldly pain of after-sorrows. When you have lost her, when the light is gone out from your life, and the world stretches before you a long, dark horror. Even then, a half-enchantment mingles with your despair. And who would not risk its terrors to gain its raptures? Ah, what raptures they were! The mere recollection thrills you. How delicious it was to tell her that you loved her, that you lived for her, that you would die for her. How you did rave, to be sure, what floods of extravagant nonsense you poured forth, and oh, how cruel it was of her to pretend not to believe you. In what awe you stood of her, how miserable you were when you had offended her, and yet how pleasant to be bullied by her, and to sue for pardon without having the slightest notion of what your fault was. How dark the world was when she snubbed you, as she often did, the little rogue, just to see you look wretched. How sunny when she smiled. How jealous you were of everyone about her. How you hated every man she shook hands with, every woman she kissed, the maid that did her hair, the boy that cleaned her shoes, the dog she nursed, though you had to be respectful to the last named. How you looked forward to seeing her. How stupid you were when you did see her, staring at her without saying a word. How impossible it was for you to go out at any time of the day or night without finding yourself eventually opposite her windows. You hadn't pluck enough to go in, but you hung about the corner and gazed at the outside. Oh, if the house had only caught fire! It was insured, so it wouldn't have mattered. And you could have rushed in and saved her at the risk of your life, and have been terribly burned and injured. Anything to serve her. Even in little things that was so sweet. How you would watch her, spaniel-like, to anticipate her slightest wish. How proud you were to do her bidding. How delightful it was to be ordered about by her. To devote your whole life to her and to never think of yourself seemed such a simple thing. You would go without a holiday to lay a humble offering at her shrine, and felt more than repaid if she only deigned to accept it. How precious to you was everything that she had hallowed by her touch, her little glove, the ribbon she had worn, the rose that had nestled in her hair, and whose withered leaves still marked the poems you never care to look at now. And oh, how beautiful she was! How wondrous beautiful! It was as some angel entering the room, and all else became plain and earthly. She was too sacred to be touched. It seemed almost presumption to gaze at her. You would as soon have thought of kissing her as of singing comic songs in a cathedral. It was desecration enough to kneel and timidly raise the gracious little hand to your lips. Ah, those foolish days! Those foolish days when we were unselfish and pure-minded. Those foolish days when our simple hearts were full of truth and faith and reverence. Ah, those foolish days of noble longings and of noble strivings. And oh, these wise, clever days when we know that money is the only prize worth striving for. When we believe in nothing else but meanness and lies. When we care for no living creature but ourselves. End of section 2.